Mercy, mercy. I'll tell you, that love, respect, and admiration goes two ways, because when I got to that place, I needed somebody with a little bit of courage and somebody with a couple of good ideas that knew what was going on, and I found that person in the person of Gay, who helped me immensely in that first year, and probably helped me to save my sanity, really, and maybe saved my seat on the board. I'm not sure. My name is Carl Budd, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm from Rock Springs, W, and I say that in order to maintain Wyoming's anonymity. Now, should you not like what I say here tonight, I don't want you to hold it against Wyoming. There's a lot of good AAs out there and a lot of good people. So that's why I want to warn you ahead of time that don't hold anything I say against where I come from. My sobriety date is January 4th, 1968. And I belong to the Rock Springs group in Rock Springs, Wyoming, and you'll see me attending when I'm there about three meetings a week in that group. It's a very good home group, and if any of you ever pass that way, I'd invite you to come and share your sobriety with us, and we'll share our bad habits with you. We don't discriminate against anybody, so I would certainly encourage anybody that comes through to look us up. I'd also like to tell you that, in the 30 years I've been around AA, I've probably heard all the BS you can hear from one of these podiums, and I've handed out my share of it. So don't listen to too much I say tonight, but if you really want to know if I'm doing, what I say I'm doing, I'll tell you. My address is 1405 Collins Street in Rock Springs, Wyoming. And I'd advise you to come by and check on me once in a while, and you'll find out whether I'm walking the walk as well as I talk the talk. And that's what I look for when I, listen to a speaker, and I like to know, is that guy attending meetings? Has he got a home group? Does he sponsor a few people? And is he a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous? And if he is, then he's qualified to speak anywhere in Alcoholics Anonymous as far as I'm concerned. So I'm just telling you, if any of you want to check on me, and you should, because you'll never know unless you do whether I'm doing this or whether it's just all hot air. So having those few little preliminaries out of the way, before I get very serious, I want to tell you that this is certainly a humbling experience. It's really an honor to be a part of anything that has the ongoing tradition that this roundup has. I've been around long enough to know that anything here that's lasted consistently for 36 and a half years is good. Bill said years ago, he said, if something in Alcoholics Anonymous is not good, you don't have to worry about it because it won't last. He said, if it's not good, it'll fall by the wayside and you won't have to worry about it. And if it's good, it'll last and it'll go on and on and on. So I would say by virtue of your 36 and a half years of longevity, I don't have to be a genius to know this has got to have been good or it would not have survived this long. And that's, due to the dedication of some good AA members that have worked hard, I'm sure, to keep this tradition alive and to keep the spirit of this tradition going. And I certainly commend you for it. And like I said, I'm humbled to be here, certainly humbled to be here. And I'm so proud to be introduced by somebody that I honor and look up to as a good service-minded servant of Alcoholics Anonymous like Gay is. I'll tell you one thing, we need more people elected to those service positions in Alcoholics Anonymous of her ilk that has the courage to stand up for the traditions, to stand up for what's right, and to, carry the message that, we still honor the traditions out here in the fellowship, and we still believe in sponsorship and, the traditional values set forth in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she's one of those people that champion those virtues. And like I said, I'm certainly honored to be introduced by her. And you could not have had a better trusted servant in the last 4 years than she has been. I certainly hated to see her rotate off the board. I would like to say that I have known some of you people for a long time, and it's really nice to come here and meet some of my old friends again. I was astounded when I came here. I met several past delegates that are a part of this thing. I go to lots and lots of meetings where you never see anybody in those roundups that have ever been involved in any kind of service activities, And there's several past delegates in this meeting here. One of the past delegates, Chuck, was a panel 30 delegate that I served with at the General Service Conference in 1980. Dedicated service person after all these years, he still comes here to hear what the speaker has to say, because he knows this is how Alcoholics Anonymous work. Milton and Joanne and Juanita and Bob came out to Wyoming, and let me tell you, I took them down to my group, and they set us back 5 years. Hell of a fire. I've still got pigeons that I'm trying to get straightened out. That I told them the truth, and these guys came and screwed it all up. I'm still trying to explain, why they said what they said, and tell them, well, that's the way they do it back on the other side of the Mississippi River, but we do it different out here, see. So, no, we had a wonderful time, and it was just an exceptional experience for us to host them out there, and I would hope I could encourage them to come back again, or any of you that might pass that way. I would like to thank the board and Kevin and Milton for inviting Audrey and I to come and share this weekend with you. Like I said, it's really an honor and a privilege, and I don't take this invitation lightly. I wanted to thank Bob for starting this off last night on a good note. An excellent AA talk, and that's the essence of a good, roundup to me is, get it started off right, and he certainly set the tone for a good meeting. Audrey this morning, when she talked, I've heard her sad story several times, and I got a little tear in my eye when she started talking, And she kind of, she kind of touched me a little bit, especially when she talked about the terrible trauma of handling my retirement, Oh, my God, of all things, I'm the guy, I'm going to introduce myself to her when we get home. I'm going to tell her I'm the guy that's making this retirement possible. I'm the guy, I'm Carl. I'm the guy that brings the paycheck home. But I was so touched that I am actually going to offer in front of all of you to let her play with my dog at least 3 days a week. That seemed to be her biggest problem was me playing with my dog 7 days a week, so I'll let her have him 3 days a week, and everything ought to be fine. No, I'll tell you, I'm so glad she was able to come with me, because about 8 days ago, she was not able to speak a word for several days, and I would not have guaranteed, that she could have would have been out of bed, to come. So I'm really grateful, for her to be here, and I want to tell her, from the podium, I love her very much. I'll tell you, I never do one of these things that I'm not nervous, and I'm certainly nervous tonight. I, like I said, I. would like to stand up here, you know, and tell you all about the 12 steps and the 12 traditions and all of that, but I watched that sobriety countdown and I said to myself, now how in the hell are you gonna tell all them old birds about the steps and the traditions, you know? Hell, they know more about them than you do. So I would be honored tonight if you would let me talk a little bit about what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And then when, you know, your next, you know, usually when I speak somewhere, you know, God, when I'm done, you know, hell, I send all the newcomers scurrying for their big book, you know, hell, then my big book doesn't say that, you know, my book doesn't say that, so I'll spare all of you that tonight, and I'll talk a little bit about what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. So, as Gay said, 2 years ago when I was elected to the Board of Trustees, I went to my first board meeting really reluctant because, you know, out in Wyoming, we're pretty far out in the sticks. We got the smallest AA population, we've got the smallest population of any state in the Union, and we're about 10, 15, or 20 years behind in our, you know, philosophy in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't apologize for that. I think it's good for us. I'd rather be 20 years behind in AA than I would 20 years ahead, because we have modernized this to the point where I've seen it in some places where people are sponsored by analysts and psychiatrists and a few other things. You know, we're still sponsored by alcoholics out there, so I don't apologize for our backwardness. But anyway, when I went to that first board meeting, boy, I was really nervous because I'm a, you know, I thought, boy, when you take a guy like me with a third grade education, a 30 IQ, and about a 9-year-old mentality and send him up there with those birds in New York City, you're probably in trouble. But they wrote and asked me to share at the first board meeting I went to. And I didn't know anybody on the board. I had been out of touch with, you know, I wasn't out of touch with service work, but I hadn't been in touch with any of the people that had been elected as trustees recently. And so I really was, here I am going to the first board meeting, and I'm going to be speaking before a group of my peers at the highest level of service in AA, or at the lowest level of service in AA, whichever way you happen to, view that. And I thought, my gosh, I don't know any of these people. And I was really nervous, you know, and I didn't know what I was going to say. And I just got up there kind of shaky, and I thought, God, if they don't like what I say, they might revoke my sobriety, you know. Well, I come here with 29 years, I might go home, with nothing. They might just send me packing, you know. So I was pretty nervous when I got up there to speak. So when I did, I opened by saying, I just said what was on my mind, which was the truth. I said, you know, really, I get up here tonight just like I am tonight, and I don't have any idea what I'm going to say, because I'm really not sure which one of us is going to speak tonight. There's several of us in here, and I'm not sure, who's going to make the AA talk. Somebody will wander by pretty soon, you know, and we'll get started, but I hope he'll show up pretty quick, you know. But I said, the worst thing that happens is sometimes somebody wanders by and he starts to talk, see, and he gets about halfway through it and somebody else wanders by and pushes him out of the way and finishes the talk. And that's when it's really bad. But there was a Class A trustee that was a psychiatrist on the board, and I had just met him that afternoon, but they introduced me to him and said he was a clinical psychologist and an expert in the field of drug abuse and alcoholism. He serves on the faculty at the University of Nevada. And so as I was making my opening remarks and trying to think of something to say, you know, that old keen alcoholic mind that that just jumps right out, came to me, and I looked out there and saw John sitting there in the front row, and I thought, this would be a good opportunity to get some free analysis maybe. So I said, and by the way, John, I said, while I'm speaking here, would you mind taking out your pencil and making some notes? And when I'm done, why, let me know who showed up to make the talk tonight. You know, I'd be grateful. You know, I, you know, the freeloading alcoholic always wanting to get something for nothing. So I thought, well, maybe I'll get a little free analysis as we're going along here. So, yeah, I finished my talk, you know, and when I was through, John sidled up to me and he said, "Carl, I've got some bad news for you." And I said, "What's that?" And he said, "Nobody showed up." So I'm not sure. Hell, nobody might show up tonight. With that, I would like to say that I was born and raised on a ranch in western Wyoming. I was a product of the Depression times. I was born in 1932, and I believe that for anybody about my age, you know, they know what 1932 was like. There wasn't anybody very wealthy, and a lot of people didn't have anything. My family were you know, ranch people. My dad owned had a pretty good sized ranch. He was paying for it, you know, and making payments on it by the cattle he was raising and selling, and times were hard, and you know, he was scuffling like hell to make a living. He was scuffling like hell just to pay the interest on the note because he wasn't making enough money to, you know, selling cattle to make payments on the ranch. So a lot of those people were being repossessed and put off of their land and stuff during that time. Times were tough. So that's what I was born into, and it was a hard-working family, and that ranch was a working ranch, and my dad always had a bunkhouse full of cowboys around there. He hired those guys. They'd ride the freight trains in down to Kemmer, about 85-90 miles away, and they would, a lot of them would either walk up, you know, or hitchhike up to Big Piney, and then they'd walk out to those ranches and ask if they could have a job. And they'd work for room and board. If you'd just give them room and board and cigarettes, they'd work all, you know, because they were tired of bumming, they were tired of riding freight trains, and they were tired of, you know, being hungry. And so my dad always had a bunkhouse full of people. When I was 5, 6, 7 years old, those people were my mentors. I learned most of the bad habits I ever learned from those cowboys that hung around that bunkhouse. Boy, they told those, you know, told those stories about places they'd been and things they'd done, you know, about the whiskey they drank. And so when I was 4, 5, 6 years old, I learned how to roll Bull Durham cigarettes and pitch dollars and play poker and, you know, tie knots and, you know, do all the things, you know, braid leather and just do all the things that those people knew how to do. And they were my heroes. I didn't have a very happy childhood. I was born mad. My mother told somebody once, she said, Carl never had any childhood. He was born old. What my mother didn't know was I was born with the symptoms of alcoholism that are described in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And long before I ever took a drink, those symptoms surfaced in me. And when I was 5, 6, 7 years old, I was restless, irritable, and discontented. And I didn't have any idea why I felt that way. I had 3 brothers. I was the 3rd of 4 boys in that family. We were all 3 years apart, and we were all treated the same. We grew up in the same household. We ate the same food, slept in the same beds, were assigned the same work jobs, and we were, none of us were, you know, we were all treated exactly the same. My other 3 brothers were probably, you know, about as normal, grew up about as normally as anybody could, and they never seemed to ever feel like I felt. And I can remember when I was 5 or 6 or 7 years old, thinking and knowing that there was something wrong with the world, and I didn't know what the hell it was, but there was something badly wrong with it, and that it wasn't a good place, and I didn't like it. I mean, I just made up my mind I didn't like it, and it wasn't going to be a good place for me, and it wasn't a good place for me. I was always frightened and intimidated by my brothers. I was, you know, the only people that I really got along very well with were those cowboys that lived in the bunkhouse. And when I hung out with them, they kind of, you know, showed me a little, you know, paid a little attention to me, and I got along with them pretty good. And they became, you know, my peers. But I started going to school in town. I went to a country school the first couple of years, and I didn't feel like I fit in there. I didn't like school, and I started going to town to school when I was all about in the 3rd grade, you know, and I really didn't like that. I didn't like any part of it. I didn't like, you know, I just, like I said, I felt like the hole in the donut. And I never could explain why I felt that way, but that was just the way I felt. When I was 11 years old, it was during the Second World War, it was about 1942, I guess, or 43, I guess it was 1943, my oldest brother joined the Navy and went through boot camp, and he came home from the Navy and on furlough, and borrowed my, and after he was there a few days, and he was going to go back, and he was assigned to a destroyer that was going to the South Pacific on destroyer duty. And during that time, 1943, that was, you know, pretty bad times. And, you know, I grew up listening to the radio about the war reports, you know. Hell, every time we came in from the field, we turned on the radio to find out who was winning the war. And I, you know, being at 12 years old when that war was going on, I was highly impressionable, and that was important stuff to me, you know. So when he came home, why, he'd been there a few days, and they knew he was, you know, leaving to go back overseas and everything. So he wanted to borrow my dad's car, so he borrowed the car and took the brother that was just older than me, 3 years older than me, and himself. And my dad said the only way they could go was if they took me along. So they took me along with them and went to town. We lived about 14 miles out of that little town of Big Piney, Wyoming, and so we went downtown, and it's just a small town, about 300 people and two bars, and they certainly couldn't do what they wanted to do in a little town like that, so they decided to drive down to Kemmer that night. So Kemmer was 70 miles away, and a little bigger town with about, you know, 20 bars and a few other amenities that would appeal to a young sailor, you know. So they bought a quart of whiskey, and we went to drove down to Kemmer. It's about an hour and a half or 2 hour drive. So on the way, while they drank and passed this bottle back and forth, so I told them, if you don't let me drink out of that bottle, I'm gonna tell Dad when I get home what you guys are doing. So, hell, they passed the bottle back to me, and I had a couple of pulls, you know. Well, I'll tell you one thing, I like that stuff. It was kind of magic to me. And by the time we got to Kemmer, hell, I felt about 6 foot tall and bulletproof, you know. Well, what they wanted to go to Kemmer for was, Kemmer had a famous old hotel in its midst, and that famous old hotel was called the Southern Hotel. Now, that doesn't cast any aspersions on the South. They called it the Southern Hotel because it was in the southern part of Kemmer, and it was down under the hill. And that famous old hotel rented rooms by the hour, or sometimes by the minute, as the case might be, you know. So they ended up down here in the Southern Hotel, you know, and here I am, 11 years old. Well, I've never seen a jukebox before. I've never seen never been in a honky-tonk ever, you know. I've been in some of those old dirty bars up there around Big Piney, you know. But, man, I went in that place, and here's those girls, those skimpy outfits now. They're out there hustling that parlor, you know, dancing with the guys, and that jukebox is playing, and they're burning incense, and they got those purple lights in there going around, and man, I want you to know, and they liked me, you know. Hell, they set me up on the bar, and I got some attention, and I liked that. By God, I'll tell you, I liked it a lot. And I know damn well, you know, that that old song, "How Are You Gonna Keep Them Down on the Farm After They've Seen Perry," could have been written for me, because after that, it was going to be pretty damn hard to keep me down on the farm, and it was, you know. That from that time on, I all I ever dreamed about was that kind of life. Looked a whole lot better to me than looking, you know, down the tail end of that workhorse that I, you know, was walking around that field out there, you know, pulling that hay rake or something. So I never was satisfied anymore after I'd, you know, seen those sights. Now, I know what some of you are thinking, and I, you know, some people have suggested this to me before. Well, no wonder Carl drank, you know. God, you know, at such an early age, why he went to that place and lost his virtue, why he had a reason to drink. Well, let me assure you, I didn't lose my virtue at that place that night, so I can set you to rest at that. Now, I do remember my first sexual encounter, you know. It was, I was apprehensive, and I was embarrassed, and I was reluctant, and I was alone. And so, you can You can all rest assured that you don't have to blame those girls for my demise. It just didn't happen that way. It would have been a lot more glamorous if I could tell it that way, maybe, but it wouldn't be right. So anyway, you know, when I started that way of life, drinking just became a way of life to me. And I noticed once I had that first drink, that hole in the donut filled up, and I didn't have that feeling that I'd had before when I just absolutely, you know, I just didn't feel like I belonged and I didn't fit in. And I'll tell you, you'll never hear me knock alcohol, because you'll never hear me knock drinking, because I'm thoroughly convinced that if I had not a drank when I was a teenager, I would have been an early teenage suicide. I don't believe I could have coped with life as harsh as it looked to me, the way I viewed it from the time I was, you know, even 5 or 6 years old. And later on, when I didn't drink, I got that feeling every time I, you know, I was sober, and I never felt right again unless I could have a little alcohol in there to make that, you know, make that feeling go away. By the time I was 14 years old, I was running a trap line, making my own money and buying enough whiskey to drink when my folks were gone. I'd buy it by the half pint and put it on, you know, hide it under a board pile in the garage at the ranch. And when my folks were gone, I'd drink, you know, and I'd drink until I, you know, when I was 14 or 15 years old, I was drinking until I'd pass out, and I'd pass out and come to and drink some more. I just liked that stuff, and I liked what it did for me. And once I found out the magic of it, it just, it got a hold of me. In that little old town where I lived, it was, you know, we were kind of backward and behind times, and my dad, you know, my family didn't have anything against drinking. They wanted me to act like a man and to be a man, and they expected me to take on the responsibility of living like that. When I was about 15 years old or 14 years old, I guess, maybe I was when I was 14, my dad took me down to a bar and introduced me to the bartender in town and told the bartender, "Now, when this guy comes in, if he's got the price of a drink, I want you to serve him." He said, "I don't want him buying a quart of whiskey and riding around in the car with these damn guys that are, you know, driving around drinking and drunk and get killed in a car wreck." He said, "As long as he can behave himself in this bar, and if he can act like a man, he's got the price of a drink, I want you to serve him." So from that time on, when I felt like drinking, and when I was in school, a lot of times while the other kids were eating lunch, I went down to the bar and drank a couple of beers and, you know, went back to school in the afternoon. And I didn't think anything was wrong with that. And I didn't see anything wrong with it. And my family didn't see too much wrong with it, because, you know, they didn't know anything about alcoholics. And they expected me to, you know, to act like, you know, act like I was responsible and to take the responsibility for my actions. So I'll tell you, when I was 17, just as I turned 17, my brother, 3 years older than me, got killed in the Korean War. And I was already pretty well into drinking, and I wanted to join the Marine Corps immediately, you know, after he got killed and go. And he went right at the very first of the Korean War. He went over with that 1st Provisional Marine Brigade, and he only lasted 13 days before he was killed over there. So I was still 16 years old, and I when he got killed, I was 16 at that. He was killed in August, and I didn't turn 17 until November. And so I wanted my folks to sign for me to join the Marine Corps when I was 17, you know, and you can go and do what I felt like I wanted to do. And my older brother was called back in the reserves, and my other brother had been killed over there. And so, you know, my mother just, you know, she wouldn't sign for me to go back over there and take a chance on having another son killed over there. And I didn't understand that at the time. I was, you know, I was certainly immature and selfish, and I didn't have any concern for what she wanted to do. I knew what I wanted to do, and I felt justified in wanting to do that. And they wouldn't sign the papers for me to go, and instead they encouraged me to go to college. So that year I went to college when I was, 16 years old, and I turned 17 in November that year. And when I went to college, I was so, you know, grieved by my brother being killed that it just going to college just didn't work out for me. And so I started drinking as soon. I went to St. George, Utah, and I lived up in Wyoming. So St. George is about 130, 140 miles from Las Vegas. And that's a hell of a poor place to send a, you know, a son for a high school or for a college education that's got all the bad habits, I'd started to do a choir, you know. So for that first year, I'd wait till the weekend and I'd buy a Greyhound bus ticket from St. George to Las Vegas on Friday afternoon, and I'd hitchhike back on Monday, you know, broke and sick. And I did that until Christmas time. And at Christmas time, I just couldn't handle the grief of, my brother dying. It just, when I didn't drink, I hated the whole world. And I already had that restlessness, irritability, and discontentment. And when I sobered up and I'd think about what had happened to him and what I wanted to do and what I was doing and everything, the only way I could handle that was just drink some more. So that, I drank from September until Christmas time. And at Christmas time, I got so toxic that my landlady came home where I was living and found me on the floor beside the bed. And she, I was just so sick and weak, I couldn't get up in the bed. And I'd been on the floor there about a day and a half. And I'd been crawling back and forth from the bedroom to the bathroom, you know, and sometimes I didn't make it. And that house was a mess. And she called an ambulance and took me up to the hospital. So the doctor, ran some tests on me, and I don't remember all that he told me, but the one thing I do remember that he said to me was that I was suffering. He said, looking at my blood samples and the test that he'd taken, I was suffering from alcohol poisoning. So what I thought he meant was that I had gotten poisoned by some bad whiskey. So I thought, if I drink a better brand of whiskey, I won't get poisoned with it. So I started buying, bourbon, 100-proof bourbon whiskey. And for quite a few years, that's all I ever drank was 100-proof bourbon whiskey, because I didn't want to get poisoned again. And I really believed that, So I drank for quite a number of years. I was married when I was I drank my way out of school by the end of the spring semester, and a couple of weeks before I would have gotten through my first year, why they kicked me out of college. And so I went back home without any credits or anything, and my dad figured out it wasn't a paying proposition to send me to college. And by that time, I was, pretty well on my way into the drinking scene, and it wasn't going to do much good. So I didn't go back to college. The next year I married a girl from down at Kemmer, and we went up to the ranch and started our life up there, and that didn't work out very good because of my bad habits. I had a lot of bad habits, and they were drinking. My family wasn't very proud of me, and I wasn't too proud of what I was doing. And so it wasn't very long till my family asked me to leave the ranch. And so the time I was 21 years old, I had left the ranch, taken my wife, and I went to work in the oil field and started making my way, out on my own. My family, my great-grandfather started the town of Big Piney. He drove a herd of cattle in there in 1868 from out in California. He was one of those people that went to California and came back and settled the West. He drove a herd of cattle from Grass Valley, California to Big Piney, and when there wasn't anybody living in that valley, and he just claimed all that country. So my family were all, that was a prominent family in that country. My dad had, by the time the war came along and, the Depression was over, and he was quite a successful rancher and had a good reputation, and he was the director of the bank there, and, they couldn't understand what was wrong with me. There wasn't anything wrong with my oldest brother that had been in the Navy. He drank a lot, and he would, he'd been wild, but he settled down. He started ranching. He started doing all those things that you're supposed to do. They kept waiting for me to do that. I couldn't do it because, I was different. I had that disease that they didn't understand, and I didn't either, so finally, when they asked me to leave, we had a bitter scene, and I left there, and I vowed I'd never go back on that ranch, and I'd never speak to those people again. I didn't see how they could treat a son that way, so we dissolved partnerships, and so I went to work in the oil field, and I didn't have anything to do with my folks for about 15 years. I, off and on at different times, I'd come back to Big Piney and work in the oil field there, and we'd pass in the grocery store and never acknowledge one another. I ended up with three children that they'd see in town didn't know their grandparents. Their grandparents didn't know who they were. So By that time, I was working in the oil field, and that was a good place to... Those were hard-drinking people. The oil field, everybody worked 7 days a week, and they worked 365 days a year. If those rigs were working, they worked 24 hours a day, three shifts, and there was three crews. So every 6 weeks, you'd change towers every 2 weeks. So the way that rotation always worked out, you'd start out and work, 2 weeks of evening tower from 4 to midnight, and then you'd have a short change when you'd, come in at midnight, and you'd go back out at 8 in the morning and work from 8 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon, and you'd work 2 weeks of that shift. And then you'd have a short change when you'd come in at 4 in the afternoon, go to work at midnight, and work 2 weeks of that. And when you got off of that shift at 8 o'clock in the morning after 2 weeks, you didn't have to go back to work again until 4 o'clock. You got off at 8 o'clock on Saturday morning, and you didn't have to go back to work until 4 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. That's what they called a long change, and that was 32 hours off. And that's when we really got drunk, So when those people wanted to drink, they bought whiskey and carried it in the crew car to the rig and back from the rig. And the guy that drove that day, he was responsible for the libations. And I'll guarantee you, if he didn't bring something to drink, he didn't have a job, Hell, they just, the driller just fired him. Hell, if he didn't bring, bring a case of beer, a quart of whiskey or something like that, he just didn't. So the oil field was a good place to work and drink. And I learned how to drink and work. Drinking to me by that time wasn't a party anymore. It was just, I was doing maintenance drinking, And so I worked in the oil field and drank for quite a few years. My wife and I started having a lot of problems with it. We had, fights and quarrels over it. She couldn't understand why I couldn't stop drinking. I couldn't understand why she nagged me about it. And I couldn't tell her, when I don't drink, I'm so frightened of living when I don't drink that I couldn't work in the oil field. If I wasn't doing this, I wouldn't have the courage to make a living out there. The oil field was a dangerous place to work. They killed a lot of people on those rigs, That was one of those places where if anybody that knew much about the insurance business in those days would tell you that they had to, if you wanted to buy insurance, you were working in the oil field, they had the highest rate for accident rates of anybody, and so their rates were awful high. So I liked that kind of work, and although it was dangerous, I couldn't tell my wife, I can't quit drinking because it just doesn't work that way. And so we fought a lot about it, and finally, she thought I was an alcoholic, and I thought she was crazy, and it turned out we were both right, So I got her I started taking her to see a psychiatrist because I wanted her to get some help. I thought, if I'm really an alcoholic, and she's really crazy, one of us needs to be all right to raise those kids. So I got an appointment to see a psychiatrist for her, and I started taking her down to Salt Lake City to see that psychiatrist. And then we started going to a marriage counselor on the side, trying to patch up her marriage, and it just wasn't working. So we went for two or three sessions, and then, it came after a while why they wanted to talk to me, and I was highly suspicious of talking to any psychiatrist, because I was afraid that guy was going to pin me down and find out, how phony I really was, and I didn't want any part of that. So the session I was supposed to, go to the psychiatrist and visit with him, we had to drive down from Big Piney to Salt Lake City, and I knew that was going to be bad because, boy, my wife was, she was bitter about my drinking, and I'll guarantee you she didn't know anything about Al-Anon, and she didn't want to, and she hadn't learned anything about this detachment that Audrey was talking about this morning, I'll tell you. So that last session, I never will forget, we started for Salt Lake City, and I made up my mind I wasn't going to say anything because I said, if I'm taking her to a psychiatrist, and I'm going to see the psychiatrist today, and I say anything to her, she's going to tell the psychiatrist what I said, and then they're going to use that against me. So I said, I'm not going to say anything to her all the way down there. Well, that's a 3-hour drive. So I bought a 6-pack of beer and a pint of whiskey, and we started for Salt Lake City, and I drove all the way down there, and well, when we got in that car and left town, her mouth started like this, and she's talking right in my ear, and God, I'm thinking, oh, mercy, give me a break. And man, I never said anything because I didn't want to rebut her and give her some ammunition. So we rode all the way to Salt Lake City that way, and I'm thinking what I'm going to, I'm thinking, boy, I'll tell you, I don't know how this is going to turn out. But we got in the middle of Salt Lake City going up State Street, and we're driving along there. And I had not said a word for over 3 hours, but I had a can of beer in my lap and and a cigarette lit hanging out of my mouth, and she's talking in my ear, and I'm watching that traffic, you know, driving along there. And she said something to me. I don't even remember what she said. And, you know, it doesn't make any difference. But my loud mouth has always got me in more trouble than my Jaybird ass could get me out of, I'll tell you for sure. And so she was whispering in my ear, and we were driving along there, and I don't know why I did it, but all of a sudden I just looked over at her and I said, "I wish you'd talk to my ass a while, my head aches." And when I said that, she reached over and hit me right on the end of my old big nose. Well, I had that cigarette in my mouth, and the fire flew off the cigarette down on my shirt and burned a hole in my shirt. The can of beer spilled in my lap, and I looked like I'd wet my britches, you know. My nose bled all over my white shirt, and I just looked like hell. And so I'm trying to keep from having a wreck in that traffic because my eyes are watering, you know, and I'm trying to get off the road and get stopped and everything. And we finally made it to the psychiatrist's office, you know, and I'm looking pretty bad. And I thought, my God, he'll notice now that I'm really right, you know. He'll no doubt be on my side, you know. Well, I guess when we went in that psychiatrist's office, you know, he thought I'd been on a drunk all night, and she just picked me up out in an alley somewhere, and I'd been fighting or something, and so he assumed that I really was an alcoholic. So when we went in, why, he announced to me after looking me over, he said, "Well, my wife and I think you're an alcoholic." Oh, that made me mad. Let me tell you, I was sensitive about that kind of talk. I said, "My God, I'm an alcoholic." I said, "I'm married to a homicidal maniac. What the hell are you talking about? I'm an alcoholic." My God, you know. Oh, mercy, I didn't want to talk about that. Well, I guarantee you, she got some help from that psychiatrist and divorced me. And I've never trusted psychiatrists too much since, you know. So that marriage ended not too long after that. And, you know, she gave me an ultimatum and told me it was either, you know, I either had to stop drinking or she was going to take the kids and get a divorce, you know. I didn't want her to take those kids and get a divorce, and I didn't want to lose the kids. I loved those kids dearly, and when I was home, I could come home, you know, off a three-day drunk, you know, and I did a lot of times. Like, I'd come home 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, wake those kids up, get them up and read them nursery rhymes and play with them on the floor and have a good time, you know, and that woman would just be madder than hell, you know, and raising hell with me, you know, saying I wasn't a good father. And I'd think, my God, how can you be a better father than I am? I love them kids and they love me, you know. Those kids didn't have anything against me. They thought their mother was the bad person because she was raising hell with me when I was doing something with them, you know. And that's the way alcoholism is. So she divorced me, and from that time on, you know, my life was pure hell because I had to live with the fact that I'd let those kids that I dearly loved go because I knew that I could not promise her anymore. I'd promised her so many times, "I'll quit drinking. I absolutely will not do this again. I know that this is causing us a problem, and I'll not drink anymore." And I meant it when I said it, and I believed it. And I could go 2 days without drinking, and I absolutely couldn't stand myself, and I couldn't stand life, and I just have to go back and drink. And I couldn't promise her anymore. It wasn't because I felt not only so bad for her, telling her that I'd stop drinking, but I couldn't stand myself to tell her another lie, knowing that I could not live up to that lie. And so I let those kids go, knowing that it was because I chose not to face up to that anymore and just quit lying about my drinking. And I let her and those kids get away, you know, knowing that it was because I couldn't stop drinking and I couldn't stand to lie to myself anymore. And that from that time on, I'll tell you, life was, pure hell for me. The only way I could face life was to get up in the morning and take a drink. So for about the next 3 or 4 years, I worked in the oil field and just followed those rigs around. I worked down the Gulf Coast in the wintertime, worked up north in the summer, and I never bought anything but short-sleeved shirts, you know. And the last year I lived like that, me and a guy were living in my car, and we'd been living in my car for about a year, driving around working on rigs, you know, just drinking. We'd work 3 or 4 days or a week and get it dragged up and move on. And so quite a while, and one night we were sitting in a bar in Grand Junction, Colorado, drinking, and he said, "I'm gonna call my brother and go down to to Kansas and borrow his cable tool rig and go out on the Osage Reservation and lease up some land from the Indians out there and drill an oil well, and I'm going to get wealthy. And boy, you know, when you're drinking in a bar, all them stories like that always sound good, you know. And I'd resisted. He'd told me this 3 or 4 times, and I'd resisted it, said, "No, I'm not going. Hell, you go on." But this night in Grand Junction, you know, it sounded good. And I said, "Yeah, hell, I'll go with you." So the next day, we left Grand Junction, went down to Kansas, and borrowed his brother's cable tool rig. And we were drawing unemployment, drinking beer, all we could buy with our unemployment check. We were buying propane on a credit to run that old rig. And we went out there and leased up some land and started drilling a well. Took us 3 months to drill that well, and we drilled that well, and it came in at 187 barrel a day flowing well. And it was ours, you know. And hell, one week I was flat broke, living in my car, drawing unemployment, and I couldn't pay attention. And 2 weeks later, I'm a wealthy independent oil operator. You tell me that everything that happens to drunks is bad, you know. Hell, everything that happens to us isn't bad. And that sure wasn't bad, you know, because, hell, suddenly I was where I wanted to be. And so for the next several years, you know, not much bad could happen to me because I had a lot of money and I made a lot of money, you know, but my drinking didn't get any better. It just took, 7 years, you know, for me to get in the shape that I got in when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. When I came here 7 years later, the last 6 weeks I drank, I hadn't worked in 3 years. I had been, you know, just laying around drinking, thinking about the next deal I was going to pull. I was just going to, you know, I'd get up in the morning and I'd take a couple of drinks and I'd read the Tulsa World and I'd say, read the, you know, the oil page, and I'd see what leases were up and who was wanting to sell some, who was wanting to buy some, and I'd start thinking about putting a deal together. And by 10 o'clock, I'd be too drunk to call any of my partners and put a deal together. So it took me 3 years. I started hawking the oil production I had and the leases I had and the oil equipment I had, and it took 3 years for me to go broke, you know. And in 3 years I came to at the end of that third year. I'd been crawling around on the floor for about 6 weeks, and I had drank to the point where I was swelled up like a poisoned dog. I had jowls that hung down to here. I had a lump under my ribs about the size of a grapefruit. My knees were swelled up, my ankles were swelled up as big as my thighs, and I couldn't do anything. Last, I guess, 6 weeks I drank, I had 7 seizures. I drank until I got so toxic I couldn't smoke a cigarette. I mean, I couldn't hold down smoke. I couldn't drink water. I couldn't drink whiskey anymore, couldn't do anything, and then I'd have a seizure. The wife I had at that time was, you know, a kind woman and an enabler, and God knows, boy, she put up with a lot, you know, and we never discussed my drinking. Now, I'll guarantee you, you know, they say in the book, you know, a frothy emotional appeal would seldom suffice, and it wouldn't with me, you know, and I've had 4 wives and about 9 light housekeepers, so I can tell you I've heard some frothy emotional appeals in my time, and they didn't suffice. So this woman had not given me any frothy emotional appeals because she knew if she did, I'd tell her either change your attitude or change your address. It's just that simple. I just am not going to discuss my drinking. I let a wife and 3 kids that I love dearly go because I wouldn't give up my drinking. I'm surely not going to, you know, quit drinking for an agging wife I don't have children with. So it just wasn't it wasn't negotiable. So that woman had, bless her heart, had put up with a lot from me. And when I'd have one of those seizures, she'd roll me over on the floor and pull my trousers up. And when she got me dressed, she'd take me down to the bootleggers and I'd buy up whatever we had the money for in whiskey. I'd go in that bootlegger's place, and I would be so sick I couldn't talk. I couldn't even tell him what I wanted. All I could do is hold the money in my hand. And that guy would, if I had $4 in my hand, you know, he knew what I could buy with $4, and he'd bring it back to me and give it to me, and I'd leave that place, and I could, once I got a hold of that, you know, I could get back out in that car, and I could start talking again and tell her, well, you better take me home because I don't want the cops to catch us out here, you know, you driving me around, me in this kind of shape, you know. So, and that's the way I spent the last 6 weeks I drank. I woke up one day in November after that about of that. And I don't know, it was in the afternoon. That afternoon I was on my feet, and it was one of the days I wasn't crawling. I didn't crawl because I was too drunk to walk. I crawled because I was too weak to walk. My lungs were filled up with fluid, and I was just dying by inches. And the reason I was so bloated up was because I had drank to the point where my heart rate was slowed down to the point where you've heard of people that die of congestive heart failure. Well, what they used to call congestive heart failure where I grew up was whiskey pneumonia. I used to, when I was a kid growing up, somebody in our country would die, and I'd ask my dad, I'd say, well, what did that guy die of? And my dad would say, oh, he died of whiskey pneumonia. I didn't know what that was, but what it was you drank until you slowed your heart rate down, your lungs filled up with fluid, and you drowned inside. And that's just exactly what I was doing. I was just drowning by inches inside. And this day in November in 1967, I can remember I walked out of the bathroom that day, and as I walked by that mirror, I hadn't had my clothes on, I know, in 5 or 6 days, because I hadn't had a seizure in 5 or 6 days. As I walked by the mirror, I don't know what happened, but I guess God's grace came to me. Now, if I'd had to wait to get sober for God's grace to shine on me, I would have died. And I don't necessarily think that God smiles just on sober people. I think sometimes He comes to us and shows Himself to us when we're absolutely, when we can't help ourselves and we are so helpless we can't get help. Sometimes God, comes. And I believe He came to me that day, because I'll never understand what happened. But I walked by that mirror, and I looked in that mirror and saw that guy that was standing there. And it was like I was standing outside of him, standing behind him, looking at him. And I could see those jowls. I hadn't shaved in several days. My eyes were swelled shut. And I saw this guy standing there like that, just that pitiful look. Just yellow. I was about the color of a pumpkin. And I can remember saying to myself, my God, what are you trying to prove? Just what the hell are you trying to prove? I could not believe, I looked at myself there a little bit and went out, and I told my wife, I said, I believe if you'd chain me up to the bed, I could just stop drinking. I said, I've got to do something. I'm dying. If I don't just stop drinking, I'm going to die just like I'm doing right now. And she said, I couldn't chain you up to the bed. And I said, why? And she said, because if I did, when you ran out of whiskey about tomorrow night, you're going to have another seizure. And she said, I can't see you dying in seizures. And she said, so it wouldn't do me any good to chain you up to the bed, because to keep you from having a seizure, I'm going to go down and buy you the whiskey you need if it kills you, And so I said, well, I got to do something. I don't know what to do. And she said, well, I don't either. And she said, there's one thing I thought of. She said, I read an article 3 years before. She had a son that had gotten married. And that, when her son had gotten married, they had their picture in the local paper. She had cut the picture of her son's wedding picture out of the local paper and pasted it in a scrapbook. And somewhere on this 3 years before, she had read a little notice that they used to put in the paper years ago to attract alcoholics, to call Alcoholics Anonymous. And this little piece said, if you want to drink, that's your business. If you want to stop drinking, that's our business. Call this phone number. So she went in the closet and dug out this old album and got the picture off of it and came out with this picture number that was 3 years old. And she said, I don't know, we might try this number, We called that number that afternoon, and the woman answered the phone, and she said, If you think you have a drinking problem, if you wait 45 minutes, my husband and I'll come down there and talk to you. And those people showed up at my house in 45 minutes, and the journey that brought me into Alcoholics Anonymous started right there, And there's no way in the world, except by the grace of God, I could have ever found that. There was no thought process on my part. I can't take any credit for it or one damn thing. It just happened, And those people showed up, and that guy, back in those days, 1968, Alcoholics Anonymous was still pretty anonymous, and there weren't any treatment centers at the time. A doctor wouldn't touch me with a 10-foot pole, and those guys came and sat up with me and sobered me up. They sat with me the first 3 days and nursed me through that period of time when I would have had a seizure, and got me through it. And the only condition was, is that way they did it then, when they did that 12-step work, was they had a hook, When they came to see you, they would not come back and see you if you wouldn't make a commitment. So the commitment you had to make was, would you go to a meeting with them? See, and here I am. I mean, I'm in such bad shape, I can't put my own clothes on. And this fellow that came to see me told me what he wanted. You know, he told me a little bit of his story and told me, he said, I want to take you to a meeting with me tonight. And I said, my God, I'm in hell of a shape. I said, I've been drunk here for quite a while. And I said, I ain't no shape to go out. And I said, I doubt if them people would want to see me. And he said, hell, fella, you're just the kind of people we're looking for. God, I mean, you know, in hell back then, why, those people were looking for people like me, because that was, you know, this was their lifeblood, was working with people like me so they could stay sober. Hell, you know, we've forgotten that that's the premise for, you know, what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's hard to find many people anymore that really understand that's where, you know, that's, you know, and they had to take them like they found them, and that was drunk, see? So once I told the guy I'd go to a meeting to check me out, he came and got me that night and took me to my first meeting. Well, hell, I was still drunk, and he knew when I started sobering up, I was going to be too sick to go anywhere. But once I took the hook, he took me to the meeting, and then those people came home and stayed with me until I got, you know, 2.5 or 3 days sober and nursed me through that so I could get my clothes on and go to another meeting. And that's how I started in Alcoholics Anonymous. That was, you know, that was the way we did it then. And hell, now we're thinking about writing a pamphlet about how to 12-step a wet drunk, you know. And all. I mean, that's hard for me to believe that, you know, we've gotten that far away from knowing how to handle a wet drunk in that short a time, you know. But that's where we're at. So anyway, they you know, really sat with me and helped me, and I got started in the program. I had a hell of a time because I'd been a daily drinker for so many years. I'd been drinking a quart of whiskey a day, I suppose, for probably 15 years when I started that, you know, doing that. And my morning drink had been a half pint of whiskey for so long, way back when I worked in the oil field. I'd have to get up and get those morning reports. When my feet hit the floor, I drank a half pint of whiskey and lit a cigarette, and that's how I started my day. I couldn't write the reports down until I'd done that, you know. So that first 18 months was pure hell for me, and I hung on to my sponsor. I didn't trust anybody, you know. I didn't trust a soul. And I'd go to the meetings, and they'd talk about resentments, and I'd think, God, I'm lucky I don't have any resentments. I like all these people. You know, I was sober a year and a half before I realized that I didn't trust any of them people, and I didn't know that I didn't trust any of them, and I resented them all, but they were all the same way to me, so I thought I didn't have any resentments. Those people could tell the difference between somebody they liked and disliked. They were all the same to me, so I said, well, I'm really lucky. I don't have any resentments, you know. Hell, I couldn't differentiate the truth from the false, you know. But that first 18 months, I hung around there, you know. Those people saved my life, and they started me on this road. I didn't have any kind of a faith in God, and I couldn't even say that I believed in God because I wasn't sure I did. And I was afraid. They said, if you're phony about this program, you're going to go get drunk. And so they'd ask me, you know, you got any faith in God? And I said, no, I don't have any faith in God. I never, you know, he never drank in the bars where I drank, and I'm not sure I know much about him. So I just turned my will and my life over to group, you know, and my first sponsor became, you know, my higher power, and I began to trust that guy. I guarantee you, nobody in 15 years, not any of those women I'd been married to, not anybody I knew had been inside of here where I lived in a long time, because I knew damn well I wasn't going to let anybody in there, because I knew when I let somebody in there, I was vulnerable, and as soon as they found out I was vulnerable and they knew and they were in here, they'd use what they knew about me to hurt me with when they were mad at me, and they'd be mad at me shortly. So I wasn't going to damn sure trust any of them, because I didn't want them to get in there where they could hurt me. Well, this guy, you know, became my friend, and little by little I started letting him in there where I lived. This guy was a big power line electrician. He was 62 years old, and he was still climbing them power poles, you know, running up the spikes of them 60-foot poles, you know, hell of a man. And his last year of drinking, he'd been in jail 52 times. He drank every weekend. got in a fight, got in jail. They bailed him out so he could go back to work Monday morning, took what money he had left, and he worked all week so he could pay the rest of his fine, go get drunk, get in jail the next week, you know. And this guy told me he hadn't been in jail. He said he hadn't been drunk, and he hadn't been in jail in 6 years. And I couldn't believe that. And I thought, God almighty, maybe I could do what he did. When I'd been sober about 10 months, he went to work one morning and got a hold of a 14,000-volt power line, and it just cooked him. It didn't kill him, but it was like, you know, putting him in a microwave oven. They got him off the pole, and when I came in that evening from where I was working, you know, they told me that he had had this accident, and he was up in the hospital, and I went up to see him. And just as quick as I got there, they said, he's in really bad shape, and we've got to take him down to Tulsa to the burn center. Would you go with him? His wife was in the program, too, and she was in shock, and she couldn't do anything. So they said, would you ride down the ambulance with him? And I said, sure. So I rode down to Tulsa with him in the ambulance, and just as soon as we got there, the doctor said, well, he looked him over, and he said, well, we've got to operate on him. And I said, well, what are you going to do? And he said, well, we're going to cut his arm off here at the shoulder. And we're going to cut his leg off here at just above the knee, and we're going to cut his heel off of his right foot, and then we're going to take his kneecap off on his right leg. And I said, my God, here's a guy that was getting ready to retire, you know, take an early retirement and buy a place down in Arkansas so he could go fish, you know. And I thought, oh my God, how could this happen to my sponsor? Here's a guy that's doing God's will, and they're talking about, you know, everybody trusting God. And I said, you know, Grady trusted in God. He went to work this morning and got fried, you know. And man, I got a resentment, you know, and I said to that doctor, I said, did you tell him that you were going to do this to him? And he said, yeah, I did. And I said, well, how'd he take it? And he said, well, I don't understand that guy, but he said, boy, he sure took it a lot better. And he said he took that kind of news a lot better than I would have taken it. I said to him, I said, can I go see him before you put him in the operating room? And he said, well, they're scrubbing him up right now. If you go, you can see him before he goes in. So, boy, I'll tell you what, I loved that guy, and like I said, I owed him my life, and he's the first person I trusted. My family hadn't anything to do with me, my mother and dad hadn't anything to do with me in years, and this guy had, you know, he'd become everything to me. I went in to see him, and I was trying to think of something nice I could say to him, you know, that I wanted to give him some encouragement. I wanted to make him feel a little better about, you know, what was going to happen to him. And I never will forget walking across that floor trying to think of something to say, and I walked up to that bed. And that guy looked up at me and had a little smile on his face, and he said, no, I said, that's all right, partner. He said, you don't have to say anything. He said, I've already taken that third step. Well, man, I'm telling you, that hit me right between the eyes. You know, I could not believe it. Here's a guy that had got the news that he had gotten could tell me, you know, that it's all right if that's what God has in mind for me by the faith he had in this program, that if that's what God had in mind for him, that he could handle that and it would be all right. I could not believe that, you know. Well, I'll guarantee you one thing. From that time on, it was hard for me to deny the power of God in this program and in my life, you know, and I had to start working on coming to grips with some kind of a spiritual program. And I started working at it, you know, at that point. I started working at trying to learn how to believe in God and trust God. And I got another sponsor and continued on in the program. You know, that's all I could do. And a short time after that, my dad and mother found out I had not had a drink in a little over a year, and they threw the grapevine some way. And they called me up and asked me if they could come and visit me. And I didn't want them to hang around me because I sure didn't trust them yet, and I was still, you know, kind of aggravated at them, but I didn't know how to tell them no. So I told them, well, you know, I guess it's all right. Come on down. I'm here. So they came down to Kansas to see me. And after my dad had been there a few days, I asked him if he would, you know, we got along fairly well. And you know, it was a cordial visit. And after he'd been there a few days, I asked my dad if he'd like to go to an open AA meeting with me because I wanted him to meet the people that had helped me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, sure, I'd like to go. So on a Saturday night, that group had an open meeting where they shared with AA and Al-Anons, got up to the podium and shared, you know, their sobriety, and it was just a regular one of them old-time open meetings like they used to have when everybody talked about what they used to be like, what happened, and what they were like now, you know. And my dad went to that meeting, and I you know, we sat through the meeting, and when the meeting was over, we got, you know, said our goodbyes and started home. And he was pretty silent. He didn't say anything. And I thought, boy, I've really screwed things up now, because he went there and he didn't like what he heard. And as soon as we get home, he's going to say, well, I'm going home. That's a bunch of phonies, you know. My dad was an old cowboy. He was born in 1901. And he'd rode his own boat a long time, and he didn't ask anybody for any help. And he thought if you had a drinking problem like I did, and you couldn't quit drinking, you just weren't a man. You just used your willpower and sucked it up and did what you were supposed to do. Well, we rode along there going home, you know, and he didn't say anything. And I was really worried. I thought, well, I probably, you know, screwed this up. I'd just been better off. I hadn't even asked him to go. And just about the time we pulled in the driveway, he said to me, he said, you know, by God, son, he said, that AA program, he said, that's really something. He said, you know, that'd have something to offer a guy that didn't even have a drinking problem, wouldn't it? Boy, you know, I knew we had him, you know. Hell, they throwed out the bait and he took it, you know. Well, he went back to Wyoming and he tried, you know, some controlled drinking that winter, and he tried it more than once, you know. He was 69 years old at the time. That was when he went to his first meeting. He was 69 years old. And he came back the next year when he was 70. And I took him to a meeting, and he admitted he was an alcoholic and said he was willing to try this program. The problem was there wasn't any group in that town he lived in. And, you know, he didn't have any place to go to meetings. So he stayed there about a month and a half and went to probably, you know, 20 or so meetings. And then he bought a big book and took it home with him and started to try and stay sober on his own. He got his first year of sobriety when he was 70 years old, reading the big book. His habit had been he'd take a quart of whiskey and he'd set it by the bed and he'd drink at night. And then, you know, when he went to the ranch in the morning, he'd get up and take that quart of whiskey, put it in the truck, and go to the ranch, you know. And so when he, you know, when he couldn't sleep, why, that's what he'd do. Well, he poured the whiskey out and put the big book by the bed. And so he got his first year. When he'd wake up in the middle of the night and want a drink, he'd read something out of the big book and call me on the phone. And about, you know, every couple of weeks, well, we'd have a meeting on the telephone. And that's how he got his first year of sobriety. The second year, he went. I talked him into starting a group in that town, but there wasn't anybody who'd show up. So he went to the library for the next 14 months, made a pot of coffee every Saturday night, read the big book for an hour. When it was over, he poured the coffee out and went home, and he did that for 14 months before a guy moved there from Las Vegas that had a year's sobriety, and the two of them started that group that is still in Big Piney today. In 1991, I was living in Washington, D.C., and my dad asked me to be his sponsor, and when he'd been sober about 6 months. And so I sponsored my dad, and all the bitterness that we had had in those years melted away, and I had the best relationship with my dad that two people could have. My dad was to me like everybody else I sponsored. It wasn't a father and son relationship. It was a mutual relationship of mutual benefit, both from his standpoint and mine, of sharing our sobriety. And it was a wonderful relationship. In 1991, I was living in Washington, D.C., and I had an opportunity to go home and give him his 20-year AA coin. My dad was dying of cancer. He had about 2 months to live. And he was about 2 months short of 90 years old, and he got his 20th coin at that meeting that night. And there was 15 people at that, there were 17 people at that meeting, and 15 of those people were local people there that, you know, were going to meetings in that town as a result of that group he started there. And he sponsored two of those people at that meeting. You know, within a short time he passed away, but before he passed away, that group would take a meeting up to the ranch there, drive up there 14 miles and have a meeting around that hospital bed that he was in, you know, because he couldn't get up to come to meetings, so they took meetings to him, you know, and he passed away. He had a meeting within 4 days of the time he died. He was still as mentally alert as you could be and knew what was going on. And when I went there to, celebrate his birthday with him. He had me take him up to Pinedale, that little town 30 miles away, so he could pick out his own tombstone, you know. Now, I'll tell you something. When you, you know, ride around with the guy you're sponsoring, and he's dying of cancer, and he's your father, and he says, "Would you stop in here at the mortuary so I can pick out my own tombstone?" I said, "My God, we can pick out your tombstone after you die." He said, "Oh, hell, son." He said, "I've done everything most of my life for myself." He said, "Hell, I just well take care of this too." I'll tell you, I went to tell him, you know, before I left, how much I thought of him and how, you know, much I was going to miss him in the years that we had shared together and, you know, the things that had happened to us. And I God, it was hard for me to face that. And I started to talk to him, and he just stopped me short. And he said, "Son," he said, I don't want to have this conversation." He said, "I'm going to tell you something." He said, "I don't want you to mourn me when I'm gone." He said, "For all practical purposes, this last 20 years has just been a bonus to me." He said, "For all practical purposes, I was dead when I came down there to see you." He said, "I had not enjoyed living in 10 years. And he said, "I had all the money I needed and I had everything I wanted, but I didn't have one damn thing to live for then." And he said, "This last 20 years has just been a bonus to me." And he said, "I don't want to discuss how bad anybody's going to feel when I'm gone." He said, "Boy, life don't owe me one damn thing, because I could have passed through here without having this." And I'll tell you one thing, hell, you talk about something that'll bring tears to your eyes. Now, that brought tears to my eyes. And I can't talk, you know, when I talk about gratitude in Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't know how you express gratitude for the kind of things like that that happen to people like me that don't deserve those kind of breaks, you know, and they happen because, not because we're perfect or because we do perfect things, but because of our willingness, you know, to do God's will, and He makes sure that things work out right in spite of us. I don't think God makes Alcoholics Anonymous work because of us. I think most of the time He makes this program work for us in spite of us, and I'll always believe that. Anyway, that's how my dad passed away, and I couldn't have been any prouder of that. I'll tell you a little something that happened to me after that. And I went back to Washington, D.C., and just a short time later, I was asked to go down to the Department of Interior and do a briefing for the Secretary of Interior when the Gulf War started, because they wanted to talk about the oil supply in the United States if the war broke out in the whole Gulf region and shut off the oil supply, you know, what kind of a condition we'd been in. So they assigned the staff members to about five of us to do different parts of this briefing and to get it ready and go down to the Department of Interior and talk to the Secretary of Interior. So the part that I was assigned, I got that ready, and 2 days later, all five of us went down to do that, briefing. So I'm sitting here in the Department of Interior with the Secretary of Interior around a mahogany table that's got about 30 seats around it. And these seats are filled up with congressmen, with the guy that was the director of the Bureau of Land Management, the Secretary of Interior, his aides, some undersecretaries, staff people, and all of these people are here for this briefing, you know. And so we're going around the table, and the one guy gave his briefing, and I think I was the second one that they called on, and I gave my part of that briefing, you know. And here I am sitting around this table, you know, and I'm sitting there in Washington, D.C., and I'm thinking, after, you know, I did my part and they're going on, you know, my mind got to wandering, and I'm just sitting there thinking, and I thought, look at this. How in the hell could you get from where I came from here? And I looked back, and it flashed on my mind when I was laying in that old broken spring couch there in Coffeyville, Kansas. My wife had been rolling me around on the floor to get me dressed, you know, buy me whiskey to get me out of the seizures. And I couldn't help myself. I absolutely could not help myself. I was absolutely helpless. And I could see myself sitting here in this boardroom, two blocks from the White House, talking to the Secretary of Interior that meets with the President, you know, weekly. And I'm saying, my God, you can't get from where I come from here, but by the grace of God. I thought, how in the hell? And I thought, what would these people think? I'm here telling that guy things about national security that he's going to rely on. And if he knew where I came from, why, hell, he'd have somebody up here with a butterfly net to capture me and get me the hell out of here. I thought, Jesus, God, this is just unbelievable, you know. And I was thinking about that, and I thought, my God, you know. And now I looked around there, and I looked at those people, and I thought, now isn't this something? I thought, I don't trust one of these guys. They're politicians. I wouldn't have drank with any of them, you know. I don't have one damn thing in common with any of them, not one thing in common with any of them that I know of, you know. And here I sit. How is this possible? You know, I thought, my God, how could, you know, but by the grace of God, how could this happen? You can't get from the last drink I had, I stole a piggy bank from my stepsons that had $187 in it, and I broke their piggy bank and stole the money and went on a drunk, you know. I couldn't be trusted with my stepkids' money, you know. And here I am sitting there doing what I'm doing, and I thought, isn't that something? And I started thinking after that, and I thought, you know, the amazing thing about it is I don't trust these people. I don't have anything in common with them, and they don't have anything in common with me. So how do I get the strength to do what I'm doing, to you know, to come here and do this, you know? And I thought, I know how I do it. Me and a friend of mine are going down to Salvation Army in Washington, D.C., and we're going down there taking a meeting into Salvation Army. Because there's 12 black guys living in that Salvation Army down there that don't have to go to meetings, that nobody likes to go down there because it's in a bad neighborhood and it's in a bad part of town, and they don't want to have somebody guard their car while they're in there. And me and this guy were going down there on Saturday taking a step meeting in there. And I thought, now isn't it something? There's 12 guys down there in that place that I dearly love, and I depend on them, and they can save my life by letting me help them, and I can maybe help save their life by going down there helping them. And in order I use those people down there to get the strength to come up here to the Department of Interior and deal with these people that I don't have one damn thing in common with. Now you tell me if there isn't some paradoxes in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that paradox, you know, was brought to my mind by something that Bill wrote that I have to subscribe to. And he said, such is the paradox of AA regeneration, strength arising out of complete defeat and weakness, the loss of one's old life as a condition for finding a new one. But we of AA do not have to understand this paradox. We have only to be grateful for it. And that passage went through my mind when I was sitting there that day, and I thought, that's the story, and it's so simple of what happens and how this happens. Now, how are you going to explain that? I can't explain that by saying, well, I'm sober today because I'm smarter than those guys that didn't sober up, or I'm sober today because I got a better program than some guy that came to AA and didn't make it and died drunk, or I'm sober today because, you know, I've had a better group than he had, or, you know, hell, I'm sober today by the grace of God, and only by God's grace am I here today. I have got no other reason for being here, and I couldn't be here but for God's grace. After my dad died, I went through a period of mourning and grieving, you know, over him. I missed him, and I really felt bad, and I couldn't get that justified in my mind, and I kept going back thinking, what a wonderful man he was. I thought, and he was such a wonderful man. That's why I miss him, because he started that group up there in Big Piney and he saved all those people's lives, you know. And I kept going over that and over it, you know. And there was something about that wasn't right, and it wasn't satisfying me inside spiritually. It just didn't sit in there where it should, and I couldn't come to grips with it. One day, out of the clear blue, something happened, and that came, you know, to me. And what came to me was the God-awful truth about this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that truth is my dad was a wonderful person, but that wasn't why he started that group up there to save those people's lives. My dad started that group up there because he was a desperate alcoholic. It didn't have one damn thing to do with him being good. He was a good man. But my dad was desperate enough that he needed help, that he started that group so he could get help, and those people naturally got help, and it didn't have a damn thing to do with him being good. I went back to the book to see if I could verify that in the book, and this is what I found. And I found just what Bill said is the simplicity of the spiritual part of this program, and that statement was, Bill said, "My friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead, he said, and how appallingly true for the alcoholic. This is the part that grabbed me, he said, for if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again, and if he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it was just like that." You know, I always wondered why Bill didn't say we enlarge and perfect our spiritual life through prayer and meditation. I go to groups where people are talking about improving our spiritual life through prayer and meditation. You know, Bill says in here, we fail to perfect and enlarge our spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others. You know, prayer and meditation helps to make me be a better person so I can. But if I'm ever going to perfect and enlarge my spiritual life and get through those certain low spots that lie ahead, I'm going to have to do it by working with those people at the Salvation Army down there that nobody else wanted to work with, so I could go up there to the Department of Interior and work with those people up there that I still don't, really trust and probably wouldn't have anything to do with. Now you tell me that isn't a paradox, and that's the paradox and the simplicity of this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's worked for so many of us, and I'd like to think that that's what you people are doing here this weekend, and I hope it's what you're doing when you go back to your home group, because if we don't do it, I don't know who in the hell is going to carry the message to that alcoholic that still suffers if we don't do it, and if we don't care enough about it to do it. And if we're still doing it so we can become better, and it's a contest to improve our own selves, if that contest doesn't involve working with that guy that walks through the door that can't help himself and comes in the shape that he comes in, and we don't perfect and enlarge our spiritual life by putting our hand out to him, telling him, "Hell, fella, you're just the kind of people we need." And if we need a pamphlet, to start explaining to us how bad we need those people and what to do with them, by God, we're in trouble in Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope it don't happen in this area, because you got too many good things going for you in doing what you're doing. I certainly enjoy the opportunity to be here tonight, and you people have enriched my weekend and my life, in measures I can't tell you about, but I'll guarantee you, you've done wonders for me this weekend, and I love you all. Thank you.